Every Wednesday evening at 7:30 brings you the program Here's a Pioneer. It's a weekly presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company with stand located across from the Nordale Hotel, always available and at your service 24 hours of the day at the telephone East 10A. That's Pioneer Cab bringing you Here's a Pioneer. And tonight's choice for an old-timer is the man who answers to the name of the Strawberry King of the Tanana Valley. And, of course, many of you will recognize him as Harry Badger. Now, Harry is a man who came to this country at the turn of the century. And what was the exact year there, Harry?
That I came north?
That's right.
1900.
1900. Now, to sort of introduce yourself, will you tell us something about your old home down in the States and the circumstances surrounding your decision to come north?
Well, I was born and raised on a farm about 30 miles from St. Paul, in Minnesota. And I stayed there till I was 19 years old and then came west where my father and brothers had gone when I was very small, and I was a baby, in fact. And I went out and I stayed in California for about a year and a half, and I didn't like it down there. And I came north to the state of Washington and bought a piece of cut-over land about 4 miles from Mount Vernon, a little town called Burlington. It wasn't a town, there wasn't anything there but a hovel that the loggers had used. And tried to hew out a piece of ground there that we could plant a little something on and raise some fruit trees. We were confronted with some 10-foot trees to stumps to dig out. When we got one of them out, we had quite a garden patch cleared. And lived there for 10 years. Right alongside of the man who is my partner up here now, Walter Crick. And in 97, the stampede from Dawson started. And in 98, the first ones that went from our town came back. And men who had never had over 3.5 in their lives at one time come back with from $2,000 to $5,000, and some of them more. And I was at the depot when the train came in with them. And I went up home. This was in the very latter part of 99, I should say. And Walter and I were living together then on my place. I told him what I'd seen. And, he says, let's go. I said, all right, go sell your horse. And I'll go see if I can borrow enough money on this place to get our outfit, which I did. And we went down to Seattle right after the holidays of 99. Got our outfit and landed, got onto an old cattle boat, the old Humboldt. And I heard Lutro telling about pitching around and some water coming in the windows. Didn't come in the windows on us, but when they got out into Queen Charlotte Sound, we had a load of cattle underneath in the hold.
Uh-huh.
The sea broke over the edge and started going down, and the hatches weren't battened down. So the old Swede that was running it turned the boat around.
Oh, yes.
To go back in the shelter of the island so that we could get the hatches battened down. And one of the fellows that was with me in the stateroom, he commenced to cry, and he said, boys, get up and get dressed. We're going to drown. And I said, shut up. What's the use of getting dressed if we're going to drown? We can do it just as well this way as any other.
What course did you choose in coming into this country? Where did you land finally on the Humboldt?
At Skagway.
At Skagway. Then what kind of a trip did you have over the pass?
Just hard work.
Hard work. Pulling a sled?
Pulling a sled by the neck, and we were 40 days coming in.
Snow and cold?
Snow and cold. And we landed at Tagish, went to the police station there at Tagish in the afternoon. They had handkerchiefs across our faces, and of course we all wore beards, and they were frozen fast. Policemen there wanted to know what is the matter with us. We'd gone crazy being out mushing on a day like that. We hadn't suffered any until he told us how cold it was, and then we pretty near froze to death before we got our tent up.
All right, how cold was it?
65.
And how long did it take you to get down to Dawson?
We were 40 days on the trail.
Mm-hmm. And you pulled a sled all that way?
Yes.
All the way from
Skagway.
Skagway, clear down to Dawson. Mm-hmm. About how many miles would you say that was?
I don't remember. I don't know what the distance is. I've often wanted to find out. I haven't any idea just exactly how far it is. Uh-huh. We followed the river most of the way, you know.
It was a long, tough trip. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, it was.
Uh-huh. Well, how did you find things down in Dawson? What sort of work did you do?
Well, we went mining. We hired out and worked for wages.
Uh-huh.
First thing we did, and getting good wages. And then as soon as we got enough money accumulated, why, we bought a claim on what was known as Poverty Bar.
Uh-huh.
And that didn't describe it, excepting as applied to our claim. We had the only 100-foot claim that didn't have any gold on it.
Uh-huh. Now, Mr. Badger, will you tell me about what made you decide to leave the Dawson country and come over in this area?
Well, there was a little chap by the name of Waddy that came up there in 1902, and told us they had discovered 9 feet of 25-cent dirt. That means 25 cents to the pan, or shovelful,
mm-hmm.
which would make it exceptionally rich, that depth. So we packed up, Grant Murdoch and I, and we came down with dogs. We each had dogs coming down. We're 33 days from Dawson down here, intending to come to Circle, where we could re-outfit. We were steered up the 40 mile and went up there and came down the good pasture, down the Tannenaw to the head of this slough, and then down the slough to Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm. What was the food situation down here?
It was very scarce.
Uh-huh.
Very scarce. Captain Barnett had some food, had a lot of flour, among other things, and that's one thing we were all short of. And he offered to sell that at $5 a sack, provided we'd buy a $75 outfit. And in that $75 outfit, we were required to take 3 cases of canned vegetables consisting of cabbage and beets and some other thing that was mostly water that wasn't fit for food, any of it. But that took $36 just for something we couldn't use in order to get a 5-pound sack of flour.
Mm-hmm.
So we called a miners' meeting. That was the highest court of the land. We had no marshals, and we had no soldiers, we had no lawyers, and no nothing else, excepting the miners' meeting was the law of the land. Whatever they said went. So we served notice on old Cap that he'd either turn that flour loose or we'd take it. He could suit himself about it. So the next morning, there were notices posted over town that anyone who wanted a sack of flour could come and get it, and it cost him $5. And there was an immediate line formed on Front Street that walked in one end of the store and out the other, with each man with a sack of flour on his back, until his stock was pretty well depleted.
Then Captain Barnett hadn't disturbed or had any difference with the word of the miners. That was the law.
Oh, that was the law, and everybody abided by that.
Uh-huh. I think the miners also had something to say about the Jap Wada. His name was, wasn't it?
Yes.
Uh-huh. About his bringing the news over to Dawson about this strike here.
Well, you see, when we came down here and we went out on the creeks to see about this big strike, why, it hadn't been developed yet. They had a couple of holes. Pedro had a couple of holes down on his creek, and he let us go down in the hole and scrape up a pan of dirt. Up in the dirt above bedrock, there wasn't anything, just colors. And on bedrock, we'd get a 3-cent pan. That wasn't pay at all. The same way on McCarty's claim down on Goldstream, they had no definite amount of pay, and it looked like a false alarm. And the consequence was that while there were hundreds of people came in, there were hundreds going out. Just as soon as the water ran, so they could get away, they started going back by the hundreds. Anytime you'd see a man whittling, starting to whittle on the bank of the river down here, you knew he was on his way. He was going to sail in a day or two. Well, Grant Murdoch went back to Dawson, and I stayed here. I said, there's a lot of hills here that haven't been prospected. It looks like a good place to stay. I'm going to stay and see what it looks like. And during the summer, they made a strike on Fairbanks Creek, 8 above Discovery. That's the first authentic one that we got word of here in town. We went out there to look at it, and we asked questions of the owners, and they ordered us off. Just get off of here and don't come back. So Bob McChesney and I went up on the hill and sat down and ate our lunch and talked it over, and we just stayed there until they went to bed. And we went down and got a handkerchief full of dirt and took it up and panned it in a greasy frying pan, got 2.5 out of it. Mm-hmm. So we decided it was pay dirt.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing happened on Clary Creek. When the report came in, they'd struck it on Discovery Claim, the mouth of Wolf Creek. He and I went out there, and I happened to know the man that was running along town there, hoisting out of the hole and running along town. Asked him what it was like. It's Lon Doggett. He says, wait till I get this hopper empty and I'll show you something. He took the hopper off and that long tom, which is about 5 or 6 feet long, was just a string of gold. He says, we have to clean up every 2 hours and a half.
Hmm.
So we came to town and opened up a real estate office.
How did you do in the real estate business?
Oh, did fine for a while. Spent most of it grub-staking people.
You know, you told me an interesting story, too, about a shooting affray that I suppose it was one of many in those times.
No, there wasn't very much of it. It was very rare that there was anything of that kind happen. It's the only one that we really had here that was serious. That was because the rule was here when you staked a lot, you recorded it with the town recorder, and you had to put a cabin on that within 30 days.
Oh, yes.
And if you couldn't build it, if you run out of food and had to go to Circle, which was the closest place to go, you got a 30-day leave of absence from the town recorder. That meant that ground was there when he come back within the 30 days. Well, Alec Coots had put up a cabin on his ground, all excepting putting on the roof and putting in the doors and windows, and then went and got a 30-day leave of absence, went to Circle after food. And Billy Dunkel was the town recorder at that time. I guess Billy got hard up and got drinking a little bit or something of the kind, and he got a chance to sell this cabin and lot to another guy, which he did. And so when Coots came back, why, somebody had his cabin all finished and moved in, was living on it. So he went and hunted up Dunkel, and he gave him a real old-fashioned thrashing. He just gave him a good beating, beat him up plenty. And then he went and started drinking, and after he got drunk, he thought he'd been damaged too much, and he'd got to give Billy some more of it, and he went and got a pick handle, said he was going to beat his head off. And Billy ran into George Noble's saloon on Front Street and asked George to put him away somewhere, that Coots was after him. So he did, put him in his bedroom, and as he went by, back of the bar, George Noble had a big gun laying there, a six-gun. Billy grabbed it and took it in with him. Coots came in there to beat him up and tried to get in, and George told him, no, he isn't here. He says, I know he is, and he jumped over the bar and went in and kicked the door in, and as he kicked the door in, Billy let him have it. Shot him through the chest, didn't kill him. But anyway, that required a miners' meeting. I happened to be the chairman of that meeting. And the verdict was that the first licking he got, he deserved. He had it coming. That was all right. All square up to there. But he also had a right to protect his life. When the man had threatened and everybody's present, he was going to beat his head off, he had a right to defend himself. And so Coots got just exactly what he had coming, and that was the end of it. It was thrown out of court.
Mm-hmm.
Forgotten right there.
Well, Harry, up to this point, we've looked back into the history of this part of the country, and inasmuch as in later years you have been particularly interested in agriculture, I wonder what you have to say about the future of this section. What do you think the Tananaw Valley will be like from a farming standpoint, oh, say, 50 years from now?
It'll be covered with farms just as thick as the state of Minnesota is now.
I see. What type of farming?
Well, there'll be the general farming, such as we have now, raising of foodstuffs and cattle.
Mm-hmm.
There's any amount of ground here that is suitable for cattle raising, and they can raise all of the feed that they need for them.
I see. Now, briefly, I understand that you've also been sent to Juneau on a number of occasions for the legislature.
Well, I went down there one session, 1945.
And you're still hard at it, farming out on what is known as Badger Road.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you ever so much for visiting the studios for Here's a Pioneer. Friends, you've listened to an interview with one of Alaska's genuine old-timers, Harry Badger, who came to the country in 1900. Here's a Pioneer is brought to you by the Pioneer Cab Company with the compliments and best wishes of manager Joe Coble and the staff. And remember, anytime you wish a cab, the number is East 10A, or the cab stand is located across from the Nordale Hotel. Be with us again for another presentation of Here's a Pioneer next Wednesday evening at 7:30.
Welcome, Alaskans, to another new program in the series, Here's a Pioneer. Today, for 15 minutes, we're going to interview John J. Buckley. Very well known to Alaskans in the interior as Jack Buckley. In just a moment, we'll have a few questions to ask, spin a few interesting yarns, and we're sure bring you 15 minutes that you'll thoroughly enjoy. Here's a Pioneer is presented each week by the Pioneer Cab Company. Pioneer Institution of Fairbanks, renowned for their length of service, as well as for their promptness, safety, and courtesy. Remember always, it's the Pioneer Cab, located at 516 2nd Avenue, the phone number East 10, East 10. Now, as we said, it's our pleasure to bring you John J. Buckley. Jack Buckley is a landmark, more or less, as he will describe to you in just a moment, of Fairbanks and the interior. Come on in and say hello to the folks, John, and tell us how long you've been here.
Hello, friends. I've been here just almost 42 years in Fairbanks.
How long in the North Country?
The 51 years, the 29th day of November this year.
Where were you from in the States originally, Jack?
I was born in the city of Honolulu, but reared in the state of Washington, King County.
And whatever brought you to Alaska? Was it the usual lure of the Yukon Country, the gold, the excitement in general?
Primarily gold. My father had preceded me up here and owned some property on Masterton Creek, and I came up to assist him in operating the mine.
Well, as it's the case with a lot of old-timers, you came to the Yukon Territory first, to Dawson, I take it, right?
No, I arrived in Circle City before the Dawson strike was made.
Uh-huh. And then from Circle to Dawson?
Then I left Circle in the spring of 1897 and went to Dawson. Remained there until May 1899.
Well, Jack, you've been connected with law and order in the Northland for a long, long time. Wonder if you could tell us something of how law and order was conducted in the early gold rush days of Dawson, what the situation was when you got there.
Well, to my mind, after all these years and what has transpired since the Dawson Stampede, I think that the law and order in Dawson was very exceptional for the number of people and class of people that stampeded into the Dawson country.
Are there any outstanding memories that you have of keeping law and order in Dawson? Is there anything that sticks out in your mind?
The law enforcement agency there was at that time, the Royal Canadian Northwest Mounted Police. And they maintained order in a very strict manner. There was lots of things that went on that the officers paid strict attention to, and others they allowed to operate without any interference, as long as it was conducted without any injury to anyone else. The men in charge of the Northwest Mounted Police were exceptional men, and they conducted their duties in very admirable order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're all there. Cracked up to be, then, huh?
They're all that they're cracked up to be in the way of enforcement.
Well, how about when you came to Fairbanks, Jack, in 1899? What was the situation here?
Well, I came to Fairbanks in 1904.
Uh-huh.
And have remained in Fairbanks since that time. When I came here, it was rather a small town. It was rather a boom town. Nothing had been developed to any great degree except by the old-fashioned mining method of drifting and hoisting dirt and putting it on the surface, and in the spring when the thaw came, washing it up. Since that time, they've developed new methods of mining and have improved the output considerable, as we all know.
Now, what about law and order in those days?
The law enforcement agency was the same then as it is now. It's conducted under the United States Marshal. The Marshal at that time was at Eagle, headquarters for the 3rd Division at that time. And a deputy represented his office here. His name was Ed Wickersham, brother of the late James Wickersham, former delegate to Congress. And he was in office when I came to Fairbanks in 1904, having been transferred from Circle City to Fairbanks.
I see. Let's see, how long have you been, were you connected with the fire department, Jack?
I joined the Fairbanks Fire Department in November 1905. And I remained with the department from 1905 until September 1918.
Well, I imagine that the biggest occurrence during your connection with the fire department was the gigantic blaze of 19-6. I wish you'd tell us something about it. I'll keep from interrupting. How it started, how it spread, what you did to put it out, and how it left, what condition it left Fairbanks in.
Well, we didn't have very much success in putting it out. It put us out. The fire happened on the 22nd day of May, 1906. A very warm, sultry day. Started about 4:15 in the afternoon in the what was then known as the Fairbanks Corner, or Fairbanks Building, a three-story building in which was several stores and offices, and the Eagles lodge room on the third floor. There was a dentist operated an office on the second floor of the Fairbanks Building, and on this particular afternoon he was doing some lab work in his laboratory and was using a blowtorch. And in some manner, one of the curtains on the window blew into the blowtorch, and 2 hours after that, we didn't have any Fairbanks. It started in that building, which is on the corner of First Avenue and Cushman Street, consumed the entire block in which that building was located, the block in which the Nordale Hotel now stands. The entire block was consumed. Part of the block where the Pinsky store is, up to the Pinsky building, and part of the courthouse which stood on the present site of the federal building. And then at 6 o'clock that night, there wasn't a building standing in any of that district.
Was that all more or less downtown district then, Jack?
That was all just as it is now, except for this street that breaks the lot here between 1st and 2nd Avenue.
Well, I imagine that a fire of that magnitude must have brought on the reason for relief measures. How did people live for a spell until they...
Well, most of the people backed out into the back country and put up tents. And 24 hours after the fire, they were rebuilding on parts of the ground that they could get to.
Uh-huh. What was the method of fighting fire in those days, Jack?
At that time, we had... The city had provided, I think they call it a baggage wagon, four-wheel light rig, intended for a horse. But as we didn't have a horse in the fire department, the rig was pulled by hand power. And it was the duty of myself, who was a paid member of the fire department, to depend on volunteers to come to the fire department when the whistle blew, and with them pull this rig to the fire. We had about 500 or 1,000 feet of hole, and we'd lay that, then go back and get some more and lay some more holes. And I've often remembered, in starting out of the fire hall, we'd start up perhaps with one or two men, and this thing was heavy. And we'd get out on the street, start up the street, and the bystanders on the street would holler, "Mush!" All that sort of horseplay as we tried to get, but finally we'd get enough men to go to work, and usually did a fairly good job so far as getting the rig to a fire. But the town was entirely constructed of wood, and it didn't take very much of a fire to do a lot of damage. But we were successful in most cases, except that one fire, and that one we were... handicapped by the breaking of a main. This building, the three-story building in which the Eagles Hall and this doctor's office was, where the fire started, had a cupola on the First Avenue corner of it. And during the fire, this cupola fell off, and one of our fire hydrants was right underneath the corner of this building. And when the cupola came down, broke off the hose connection on the fire line, which put the entire system out of commission, and we had to back up then to the NC powerhouse and connect our hoses there, and by that time we'd lost everything.
That was really working under just about every difficulty you can find. Was there any other conflagration that you recall, Jack?
Well, we've had two or three other fires in the same district on that same lot. We've had two fires that were disastrous. one of them in 1918. They had rebuilt another building two-story high in which there were saloons and stores and what was known then as the Tannenbaum Club on the second floor. That entire building was consumed and two more buildings east of that. But we managed to stop the fire before it got through the block.
Uh-huh. Well, there was a question that the answer to which I found very interesting last week in talking to Doc Sutherland. He was describing the comparison of the people of that yesterday and today. What do you think of the difference? Would you have rather lived back there again if you had the choice all over again or now?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I believe in progress myself, and it, when I came to the country, it was rather desolate and lonely. I, of course, noted the wonderful development that has taken place in Alaska since I came to it first. And while our life at that time was rather hard, it was hard to get the necessaries of life in here for the reason that during the summer, the merchants had to ship all their supplies and get it on the dock here by the 20th or 25th of September, and that had to last them until the following July. And, of course, naturally, there's lots of supplies that ran out during the winter. After the mail contract was let from Valdez to Fairbanks, they constructed a trail and not only carried the mail over it, but some venturous souls equipped freighting outfits and brought fresh vegetables, fruits and stuff through the winter across the trail from Valdez to Fairbanks. And in that way, we existed in pretty fair shape. It cost a little bit more money, not quite as much as it does now to fly it in, but it was expensive at that time. At the present time, it doesn't seem to make any difference what it costs. If you need it, you get it and take it as it comes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't seem possible, but it looks like we've run through 15 minutes already. It seems we just sat down, Jack. You figure the old days are more or less good for reminiscence, but the progress is really worth it, right?
Yeah, well, it has been wonderful to know that that the outside world has taken cognizance of Alaska and helped to develop it, and I hope that they will release some of the restrictions they have on it and continue to progress as the states have done in their pioneer days.
Well, I think someday that's for certain, Jack. Thanks a lot for coming in. You've heard an interview on Here's a Pioneer with the Deputy Chief U.S. Marshal, John J. Buckley of the city of Fairbanks, well known to many interior Alaskans as Jack Buckley. Each week at this time, we bring you Here's a Pioneer with the good wishes of the Pioneer Cab Company, a pioneer institution in Fairbanks, renowned for their length of service as well as for their well-known promptness, safety, and courtesy. Remember the Pioneer Cab located at 516 2nd Avenue. Phone number is East 10. Remember to listen next week, same time, same evening, to Here's a Pioneer.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first in a new series called Here's a Pioneer. These 15 minutes are presented regularly, once a week, by the Pioneer Cab Company of Fairbanks. These are our ideas from the studios of KFAR to present the men who represent a mighty era in American and particularly in Alaskan history. Here's a Pioneer will bring you each week a man who stems from the beginnings of Fairbanks, the Alaskan Territory, and the Yukon Territory. As an opener, here's a message. Often when you want to get there, you have to do it in a hurry. But you want to do it safely, too. That's the key to Pioneer Cab success in Fairbanks, promptness and safety. The passenger's comfort and safety is first in the mind of every Pioneer cab driver. A new model sedan is waiting for your call at Pioneer Cab, phone East 10, East 10. Here's a Pioneer presents, as our first interviewee, Dr. J.A. Sutherland. We believe that Dr. Sutherland is the Dean of Alaskan Doctors.
I believe we might call him in right now to see if we're right about that. How about it? This, ladies and gentlemen, is Dr. Sutherland. Are you the dean, doctor?
I believe that's true. I think that I am the oldest practitioner, both in regard to years and also in regard to years of practice in Alaska.
Now, how many years does that entail?
It's in the neighborhood of 49 years in the north.
That would make it roughly 1898, is that right?
In winter of 1997 and 98, yes.
Uh-huh. Did you come to Fairbanks immediately, or?
No, I went to the Yukon Territory first via the White Pass and Skagway. I was there for 6 years before coming down here in 1904, arriving here on the 8th day of October, 1904.
Which of the towns was it in the Yukon Territory, Doctor?
Dawson City.
Dawson? What was it like then, as a doctor would see it?
Well, from a medical standpoint, we found that there were a great crowd of doctors in there, so-called.
Yes.
There were 140-odd doctors registered at the Klondike Hotel. But of this number, only 16 were qualified to practice in the Northwest Territories. So we formed a medical board there and allowed those that had had 3 years training, which was the allotted time for medical training in those days in the United States, to come up for examination, although the Canadian requirements were 4 years training. We had quite a number come up, and I think everyone that came up for examination succeeded in passing except one man. We didn't try to keep any of the American doctors out, but wanted to give everyone a chance, if they were qualified at all, to practice medicine to do so.
Well, what about some of these doctors that were unqualified?
Well,
are there any examples you can think of?
We had one man who claimed to be a doctor, down with typhoid fever and died. From the insurance companies, we got an inquiry saying, we know no doctor so-and-so, but we have a barber of that name. We found out that he was a barber and he'd come up with a clinical thermometer and a hypodermic syringe and wanted to practice medicine. We had a lot of that to contend with, though, in the early days.
Well, you mentioned typhoid. Were there any epidemics that stand out in your memory of Dawson in those days?
The first epidemic we struck on the trail was cerebrospinal meningitis, which was extremely fatal. The men blamed it on having to haul the sleds with their by the back of their necks, having the rope in the back of their necks. But, of course, we knew that that was not the case, but you couldn't make them believe it. Then in Dawson, we had a typhoid epidemic in the summer of 98. That was a terrible scourge. The town was situated right on the muskeg and bog. There were no sanitation, no sanitary preparations at all, and the water was taken right directly from the river. So it's no wonder that they had a typhoid epidemic at that time.
Well, with the facilities you had, were you able to treat it even nearly adequately?
Yes, fairly so. The main treatment in those days was starvation. But I felt too sorry, I think, for my patients, and I would give them a little ice cream when we could get it or some poached eggs, and they seemed to come through better than those that were not allowed any food.
I have an idea, speaking of food, Doctor, that diet in those days was something totally different than it is now.
Well, the only potatoes we had were the evaporated potatoes, which they called desiccated potatoes, or, other vegetables were desiccated as well. But they did not contain the necessary vitamins to prevent scurvy, which became epidemic in the winter of 98 and 99. Not epidemic, but endemic.
I see.
And we found that if we could get hold of a few onions or a few fresh potatoes or any fresh fruits at all, that we could get good results. But a lot of them were not very... they didn't recover.
Well, what about Fairbanks, Doctor? When did you get here and how did you find it?
I landed here on the 8th of October, 1904. And it was certainly a wild and woolly town. It was more or less a tent town and cabin town. Front Street between Lacey and Cushman was a mass of dance halls, cigar stores, saloons, gambling joints. with a couple of restaurants mixed in between.
What was the size of it like? Was it...
There were about 8,000 people here in the winter of 1904, I should say.
How was the start in medicine? What were your difficulties
there? About 18 doctors practicing here when I got here. I couldn't find an office, so I went out to Cleary Creek and built a hospital out there. Stayed there 2 years and eventually sold the hospital to Dr. Danford.
I imagine the differences in practicing medicine then and now must be something terrific.
Yes, the change is simply astonishing. In those days, we treated pneumonias with poultices and just symptomatic treatment. We hadn't any of your modern sulfa drugs or penicillin. We had no oxygen for taking care of them. And it was hard work. A doctor just stay with his patient as much as he could or have a nurse with them all the time and treat the symptoms as they arose.
What about your transportational facilities?
Well, all our calls were made with dog team or a horse and cutter. Dr. Hall was here, and he had a horse and a cutter, and of course he was the kingpin of all. All envious of him having this horse. But all our trips to the creeks were made with the dog team. Mm-hmm. And we're hard. Made one trip over to Fort Yukon, and it was a long time making the trip where you can make it today for me in an hour.
Well, Doctor, I think that you can't talk to a pioneer and do a decent job of it without catching a yarn. Is there any particular outstanding recollection of a case that has stuck with you strongly in memory in all that time?
Yes, there's one case that I think is really outstanding. The case of a little Irishman out on Cherry Creek who came to me one day and he said, Doctor, he said, I want you to come down and see a man. I said, what's the matter? He said, I think I nearly killed him. I said, what'd you do to him? He said, I took an axe to him. And he had split his skull open, brought him up to the hospital. The nurse, Mrs. Biglow, Mrs. Sutherland, and myself, by candlelight, we prepared that brain as well as possible and brought the membranes back, wired the skull on. And that was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. By 10 o'clock, the Indian hadn't come too, and I said to the others, I said, well, I guess he was a bad Indian. We got an immediate retort from the vet, I'm a good Indian. So I told this fellow, I don't suppose it makes any matter whether I mention names or not. His name was Paddy McKnight.
Uh-huh.
And I told Paddy, I said, Paddy, you're in an awful fix. If this Indian dies, you'll be up for murder or at least manslaughter. And he said, Doctor, will you arrange it for me? So I rang up Mr. Harlan, the district attorney in Fairbanks, and he said, well, bring him in. I said, oh, no, I'm not a deputy marshal. You send out a marshal for me. Well, he said, we haven't a marshal available, Doctor. Try and get him in some way. I said, all right. Well, I asked Paddy, I said, how many dogs have you been? He said, I got 3 dogs, Doctor. He said, can you get any more dogs? Yes, I can get 3 more dogs. The Indian's cousin has 3 dogs. Well, I said, if the Indian's able to travel at all tomorrow morning, we'll put a mattress on the sleigh. And you and the Indian's cousin take him in, you go and give yourself up. So the Indian was brought into St. Matthew's Hospital and put under the care of Dr. Castle. Incidentally, 5 days later, the Indian was able to be out of the hospital and lived for several years later, and as far as I know, may be living today.
Well, that was a good job.
And Paddy went up to the jail. He knocked on the jail door. He said, opened the wicket. They said, what do you want? He said, I want to come in. Well, I said, have you any papers? No. Well, you can't come in. Well, what'll I do? Well, go into the marshal's office. Went into the marshal's office. They said, what do you want? Well, he said, I want to go to jail. He said, I nearly killed a man. Well, he said, who's laid a charge against you? Anyone? He said, I don't know of anyone. Well, he said, do you want to lay a charge against yourself? And very explosively, he said, no, I don't.
That sentence was deleted. Go ahead.
They sent him up to the telephoned the district attorney's office, and he said, yes, the doctor rang me up, put him in jail for a few days, and we'll see how the Indian gets along. Well, at the end of 5 days, when the Indian was able to be up and around, they took Paddy to the front door of the jail, and his pants were pretty warm when he reached the outside. That was all that was done about it. But About 3 weeks later, Paddy got drunk in the Pioneer Hotel, and he broke a few bottles of whiskey and also broke a mirror. They put Paddy in jail for that and gave him 3 months in jail for destroying whiskey where they wouldn't put... when he had a malicious attack and tried to kill a man, there was nothing done about it. And that was quite characteristic of a lot of cases in the early days here.
Yes, I was just thinking while you're telling us a bit ago about the pioneering qualities of the men that are Alaskan doctors today and the men that started out so long ago to beat the path for the men that are doing a good job today, of course. The difficulties in transportation and facilities have ironed out, but it's certainly impossible to forget the men that started it out. And there's certainly a lot of appreciation, too. Doctor, you've seen the birth, death, and resurrection, as you told me a bit ago, of Fairbanks. Now, tell me frankly, which do you like best?
I like the birth of the town best. Wild and woolly as it was really a he-man's town.
Is that, do you figure, due to retrospect, or is it just something that you'd live through again gladly?
The present town of Fairbanks is soft.
Uh-huh.
And more or less effeminate compared with what it was in those days. They were hard-working miners. They lived hard, they played hard, and they drank hard.
Uh-huh.
Like one sweet came in, was playing faro one night, he was a woodchopper. And they trimmed him. And he got up from the table. Well, he says, easy come, easy go. I go chop some more wood.
That was the spirit.
That was the spirit there. And they were all very friendly. One man would stop and help another. There was no... I've seen men here that we thought had to go outside, that were broke. Someone would go around and take up a collection. One man, they collected over $2,000 inside of an hour. Paid his way outside and paid his doctor's expenses out there. And that was the character of the people. They would help one another. Nowadays, you go out and try to raise $2,000 to help a man, and you'd have to cry your eyes out. Men wouldn't get it.
Well, the difference to an outsider, to Alaskans, is terrific even now. But I know that as you describe it, when men are faced with hardships and facing it together, why, they think together, they feel together.
They do, and they'll stop and help one another. There's one thing that your remark about the doctors of the present day has brought up. I want to say that the doctors of the present day know so much more than we knew in those days that we're sometimes wondering how on the earth we got along at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to compliment the doctors of the present day for the work they're doing. Now that I've had to give up my share of the burden, I'm glad to see that the men we have here are all capable men and are doing a good job.
Well, thanks a million, Doctor. And I guess on that note, we've just about run out of the minutes. These 15 have gone very fast.
Indeed they have.
This was Dr. J.A. Sutherland, the first in our series called Here's a Pioneer, in which each week from the studios of KFAR, we'd like to meet one of the men who made the beginnings of Alaska possible in his way. There's a difference between haste and promptness, and it's the difference you'll find in a Pioneer cab. The safety and comfort of the passenger is the first concern of every Pioneer cab driver. Late model sedans only when you call a Pioneer cab. Their telephone number is East 10. We'll see you next week, same time, same day, for Here's a Pioneer.
Thank you, Eric, and good morning to you early listeners. We have another visitor in the studio this morning whose interest in the fashionable world is worthy of our attention. Ms. Myrtle Finer, a newcomer to Fairbanks, is here on a sightseeing tour of the Northland before returning to her home in Milwaukee. Myrtle, as I understand it, you have just returned from a buying trip to that glamorous center of fashion, New York, where you were buying for your shop in Milwaukee. Since you're just fresh from the big town, perhaps you can convey some of the more vivid impressions to our listeners, particularly about what is being worn. You know, we've heard so many reports, and now we'd like to have the final word from one who has seen all. Now, what would you say, Myrtle, is the most significant change in the style picture this year?
There are so many radical changes in the fashion field for this coming fall. However, I do feel the most important one would be the length.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, what is the average length of skirts from the floor now?
The average, perhaps, would be about 14 inches. However, it does vary from 12 to 15, depending upon your own stature and your personality and your makeup. I would still suggest to wear the length that is most becoming to you.
Well, I second the motion on that. Now, Myrtle, do you think that this style will become an accepted thing among fashionable women? You know, many women I know have expressed the feeling that the longer skirts are strictly a fad and will go out like so many other fads. How well do you feel they're being accepted in various parts of the states?
Well, I'm definitely of the opinion that it's not a fad. Certainly it is being accepted universally. Some sections are a little bit more reluctant about taking it on for the time being. But in New York, they have accepted them, and even in the Midwestern sections, we are wearing our skirts longer. Somebody only yesterday, one of your Fairbanks women, asked me if it was being accepted in California, because that apparently is her home state. Well, I might add that in California, they are wearing them longer than any place else in the United States.
Well, now that is an interesting note, because this spring, when I was speaking about the average length of skirts, I did note that the distance from New York seemed to make a difference in women's willingness to accept the longer length. I understood in the spring that New Yorkers were willing to accept it, but other people wouldn't, so I see that the new skirts are becoming the thing if everyone else is taking it on.
That certainly is going to be the case, I'm sure.
Well, do you feel that there are other important changes particularly noteworthy in the New York fashion picture?
Well, the full sweep in garments, especially coats, is very noteworthy. Since the restriction L85 has been lifted and the designers are able to use their ingenuity again, they are using it to the utmost. You will find, too, that they are putting jumbo pockets on coats, whether they are fur-trimmed or untrimmed, and using the large Puritan collars, which are very interesting. And then, too, we are showing some fur-trimmed suits that are new. We haven't had them for several seasons. They offer any number of types, both in the box jacket and in the fitted type with the long torso lines, small collars out of fur with pockets out of fur. They're extremely interesting. I'm sure that they're going to be accepted very well.
Well, it certainly does sound as though designers are using their ingenuity, and after the war years and the lean years of no fashion and rather dogmatic styling, I think we're very happy to see the return of personality in fashion. Now, did you see anything that you thought was particularly interesting?
Well, we have seen on our last trip most of the preliminary showings of all the better houses. The Belciano numbers, which I am sure all of you have seen in all the magazines, are most interesting. We had one number that had a complete yoke of beaver and large jumbo pockets with the contrasting fabric woven in the yoke of the fur.
Interesting.
It was very interesting. And the same manufacturer also used the same theme, but used a contrasting fabric in a buckle treatment for both the collar and on the large jumbo pocket.
Sounds like a wonderful idea. I can't wait to see them myself.
They're simply gorgeous.
Didn't you mention something about Jap mink also being a popular fur this year?
Yes, Jap mink is coming into its own. We haven't seen it for several years, as well as beaver. Now, beaver has been prohibitive in price, of course, so it has not been on the market to any great extent. This year, it is used very lavishly and very well. The treatments are very interesting.
I think much can be done with Jap mink, and I'm very glad myself to see it back again. I remember years ago in my mother's clothes that it was used very handsomely. Now, do you think that suits are going to hold their own in popularity this year? You mentioned the fur-trimmed suit. Do you think that suits as a whole are going to stay in?
I'm sure that they have. I feel that suits have won a particular niche for themselves in the fashion picture, and I don't believe that they are stereotyped any longer. In past years, many times, the suits were simply a classic, and of course, we would become very tired of them, and we would want to have a few interesting dresses in our wardrobe. However, I do feel that the women today have become very suit-minded and realize that no matter where they are always well-groomed in a suit. The designers, too, have realized the importance of the suits in the woman's wardrobe and are using their ingenuity. The pencil slim skirts with the side closings on jackets are very interesting for this season. They are using the box jacket again with the pencil slim skirt with fur trims on them. And fabrics also are playing an important part in the suit picture. Forstmann has developed a broad cloth that adapts itself very beautifully for a fur-trimmed suit.
Well, that does sound wonderful. Now, are the gabardines going to still hold good? We've had them for a long time, but I still think it's a worthwhile fabric.
I believe that gabardine is still a top fabric.
Mm-hmm.
We are showing some of the worsted fabrics and the menswear types, shark skins, bird's eyes, and so forth, and they're manipulated very well. They really are beautiful, but gabardine still is number one.
In other words, then you'd say that a suit, instead of taking the place of a dress, is a definite picture in itself. It's a definite feature to count on at any time.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Now, you spoke about the new fabrics coming in. Do you find that these fabrics are being used in unusual colors, or are they sticking to the more conservative tones that they've used in the past?
No, the colors are very interesting this season. The wine tones and the deep greens especially are getting back. And the browns, too, have been out of the picture for a number of seasons. The browns, we find, are coming in very strong this season. The Forstmann has developed his colors in the tapestry tone field and is using the Arras and the Veronese green and the Beauvais red, which are very smart. Of course, black is always good. We know that.
Yes, yes. Black is always good at any time. And I was interested in knowing that, hearing you mention that designers were dipping back into the past for colors, and you mentioned several Italian cities famous for their colors in painting in the during the Renaissance period. We mentioned that just previously, that designers were dipping back history for color and design, and I think that's a very vital thing this year.
I think so, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that we're on the subject of color, what do you think about dark hose? I understand that there's a radical change coming up in the color of hose this season, as well as in the length of the skirts.
Yes, the dark hose are coming in, and they're very smart. You will find that it makes a costume look complete. If you are wearing a beige suit, for instance, and are having the dark brown accessories with it, keep your hose in the dark brown also, because it's very smart.
Also remembering, of course, that the hose must be perfectly sheer, in other words, very fine.
Definitely.
Sheer hose. They're the only type that can be worn with it in the darker tones.
Definitely, because they would look way too heavy if you kept them in the heavier gauge.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, isn't it true that in the darker tones, the hose has a tendency to slim the leg and give it a much longer, finer appearance?
Well, that most certainly is true, because I'm sure that we're all aware of what a white stocking will do to your leg.
That's true. Yes. I think that's a very interesting
point
of contrast. Of course, Myrtle, you've only been in Fairbanks now for only 2 days. But as far as fashion here is concerned, I think you may have registered some impressions of style consciousness in Alaska, or shall I say Fairbanks?
Well, I think you'd better leave it Fairbanks, because Fairbanks is the first large city that I've gone into. And I'm sure the small ones that I've gone through are not style conscious.
Well, probably not as representative.
No, definitely not. But I did find that in Fairbanks, and visiting your shops, that they carried very fine merchandise, well-known names in the fashion world. And I also noticed that your Fairbanks women are very well-dressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for the compliment. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting to note that one who has been all over the United States and who certainly has been on many buying trips to New York considers Fairbanks women well-dressed. Now, I might ask, just as a little sourdough footnote, did you do anything else while you were here except notice the length of our skirts?
Yes, indeed, I did. I came up here with two other girls from Milwaukee, and we have been doing just everything that's possible to do in 24 hours of the day, because that's actually what you have here is 24 hours a day. It seems very unusual for us to be able to do things at 12, 1 o'clock at night that normally we would have to certainly do in the daytime. We went out the other day to pan some gold.
Oh, how interesting.
And the men out there, Nick and John, were very kind and gave us some nuggets.
That was
our
Live and Good, wasn't it?
Yes, it was near Live and Good. Mm-hmm. Of course, the dust, I must say, we couldn't leave unnoticed, because that was very prominent. But we've enjoyed our stay immensely.
Well, we're very happy to know that you did enjoy your stay, Miss Myrtle Finer, and it was a pleasure to have you with us this morning.
Thank you.
And good morning.